You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. Now, in terms of logistics, today's Kabul conference was, to say the least, challenging. Senior officials from countries all over the world in a city where bombings are a frequent occurrence. But if that was ambitious, the agenda was daunting. How to bring peace to a country in which war has for decades now been a way of life. Well, the BBC's Lise Doucette is in Kabul for the conference. I asked her, first of all, how is it possible, really, to hold such a conference in a city as insecure as Kabul?
I have to say, Owen, I spoke to a number of foreign ministers today on the grounds of the foreign ministry who confessed that a year ago, even as much as 3 days ago, they didn't believe that the Afghans would be able to pull it off. And even as they arrived, the plane of the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and the Swedish foreign minister Carl Bildt had to be diverted from Kabul to an airport north of the capital because of rocket attacks. And so the very fact that they were able to gather so many people of consequence in one area for so long was indeed a tribute to the Afghan security forces and the bravery, if you like. It did create a lot of hassles for everyone else in the city, of course, because there was a huge lockdown. And Afghans had to ask, what, another conference? It's great that it's in Kabul, but there's been a conference every year since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. But the organisers inside that cocoon, that heavily guarded cocoon, were talking about a milestone. So when it was over, I pulled aside one of the main conference organizers, who is a former finance minister and a former presidential candidate, Ashraf Ghani, and said, well, what is really different about this one?
When we had previous conferences, we were poor and we knew we were poor. And we thought we were going to be remaining poor. I was among the few exceptions that thought we were potentially rich. Now we know that we are potentially rich. We have trillions of dollars in mineral wealth. Because of this, our position is changing. Now we are talking not just about aid. We are talking about how we are going to use this foreign assistance as a catalyst when we can generate our own money and stand on our own feet. And that is the fundamental change. For the first time in our 5,000, 10,000 years of history, we have the potential means to pay for a government that could be centered. That's the hope side, and that's the opportunity side. The risks are equally high. If they lead, remains as short-sighted and as focused on its gain, if corruption is really not tackled, if accountability does not become the norm but remains confined to pockets, we will lose the opportunity.
That was Ashraf Ghani, the former finance minister, with very eloquent talk of the way forward. And I have to say, you do get used to this very lofty phrases and big words coming out of these conferences. But there are a lot of new ones around Afghanization and transition. I think it's a coded way of saying that the foreign community, the NATO armies, are getting ready to leave and the Afghans are going to have to take over. But it was Hamid Karzai who came out and said, we want to take responsibility for our own security in 4 years' time. And his allies are saying, well, we're going to help you to do it. And I've been speaking then to the NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
It is in cooperation with the Afghan government that we have laid out this timetable. We hope that transition can start in 2011. We share President Karzai's goal that Afghan security forces could be capable to take lead responsibility all over the country by 2014. So this provides us with a timetable. But of course, the whole process must be condition-based. We will not leave Afghanistan until we know for sure that the Afghans can take care of their own security.
But in the heat of a July day in Kabul, you couldn't escape this. What was hanging in the air was that a pullout. Hillary Clinton was talking about it. So many others were talking about it. So I said to Anders Fogh Rasmussen, wasn't this just the beginning of them preparing for that pullout?
We approve today a document unanimously, according to which 2014 is now set as the date where we hope that the Afghan security forces can take lead responsibility all over the country. And I think it's a very important clarification. After months of discussions about dates, we have now a strong international commitment to one day, 2014.
That's the view of the NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, of course, who has to contend with all the views of the different NATO armies, some of which are getting out sooner rather than later. But, of course, that begs the question, will Afghans really be ready? Well, it's a question primarily for the Afghans. So I spoke today to the National Security Advisor, Dr. Rangin Spanta.
We are very happy with the conference and everything in the framework of our preparation and planning.
But you had several rockets last night. It meant a lot of the official delegations couldn't actually land in Kabul. And they didn't sleep because they had to land at Bagram Airport.
Here's Afghanistan. Here's Afghanistan. And this kind of terrorist attack is not exception here. This is possible, you know. But we made every necessary preparation for the security. Important issue from Afghan point of view is the content and the result of conference.
Because Afghanistan has now said it's ready to take responsibility for its own security by 2014.
Yes. We work on the transition plan together with the international community to take this responsibility in 2014. And I'm sure we can take this responsibility until end of 2014.
So there's agreement between your government and the international community?
Yes. Yes.
Because I think you know the foreign armies would like to leave soon.
Yes, the foreign army, the activities of the foreign army will reduce to train Afghan national security forces, and we will take the full responsibility.
So there you get a host of a whole range of official voices about this Kabul conference. What does it mean and where will it lead? It's all about trying to end this 9-year, or you can put it, a 30-year war. And if you're turning away from war, you're trying to win the peace. And of course, the way they talk about peace at these conferences now is this phrase, reconciliation and reintegration. In other words, talking to the Taliban. Now, there is a lot of support for that. We had the peace jirga in Kabul in June, and it emerged surprisingly with a consensus on the need to talk to Afghan armed opposition groups. But this is a very diverse country, and a country where a lot of people suffered at the hands of the Taliban and don't want them back. And that includes a lot of people who live in northern Afghanistan. So my colleague, Daoud Kavirzadeh, who works for the BBC's Persian television, went up to Mazar-e Sharif to see that actually there isn't a consensus when it comes to this issue.
The market in the northern city of Mazar-e Sharif is crowded with shoppers buying watermelons, new and second-hand clothes, and kitchenware. Life in northern Afghanistan is relatively peaceful, in contrast to the south, a Taliban stronghold. But it is a critical time across Afghanistan as NATO-led forces try to defeat the Taliban and train Afghan forces to take on security. One approach by President Karzai has been to try persuading the Taliban to lay down their weapons and come to the negotiating table. But talking to the Taliban divides public opinion.
The nightmare will come back. The best way for the Afghan government is not to talk to the Taliban. They can only bring peace through strengthening the security forces and defeating the insurgents.
The security situation in Mazar-e Sharif is relatively good, but the situation is bad in districts like Sholgara and Chimtal.
Day and night, armed insurgents roam around in our village. The government should know better how to get rid of them and how to bring peace.
It's a critical time for Afghans. They're torn between hope and fear. After decades of war, all these people want is peace, but not at any price. The governor of the northern Balkh province, with Mazar-e Sharif as it is capital, believes there is a lot to lose.
My fear is, let me be frank, that the achievements of the past 9 years may be compromised, particularly democratic values, women's rights and freedom of speech. The Taliban wouldn't tolerate these freedoms. It's very difficult for us to work together under one umbrella with two different ways of thinking.
Those concerns are echoed across Afghanistan, with many believing that if President Karzai's strategy of talking to the Taliban is pursued, the progress of the last 9 years could be compromised, while others think that dialogue is essential for progress.
Daoud Kavirzadeh there, reporting from Mazar-e-Sharif, and Lise Doucette still on the line from Kabul. Now, Lise, you are a very frequent visitor to Kabul and are well positioned to answer this question. If the West leaves, as it seems they're now preparing to do, Is there any way that Afghanistan can avoid a civil war?
Well, sad to say, Owen, that the C word, civil war, is mentioned. It's mentioned in conversations, and it's mentioned with a lot of concern and anxiety. I think everyone, even the Taliban, would say if there's a precipitous withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan, that this would certainly send the country lurching back into a civil war. It's simply not ready. But it is 4 years away. And I really had a lot of conversations with people today, Afghans and foreigners alike, saying, do you really think this is going to work? And from both sides, they said, look, if we have a deadline, it's going to concentrate minds, because we have seen in some areas where Afghans take command, they actually do a good job. And, you know, I've had, you know, Afghan colleagues who've been embedded with the Afghan National Army who can't even, aren't even allowed to make a decision on putting a bullet in their gun. The Americans decide everything. So give the Afghans a chance. As the Afghans say, trust us, give us more responsibility. So this is a huge test. It's the test for Afghans and for the international communities. But what a test indeed. It's almost like Russian roulette. It is truly a life and death process that's underway now.
Trust us, they say, and yet I think even today there's been another case of an Afghan soldier shooting Westerners in the country.
That is the absolute nightmare, because it's the second time in as many weeks. You know, even those countries who don't want to send combat troops say there is this nicer option. You know, you can even convince a doubting public who doesn't want their troops to be going to war to say this, and we're training them. It sounds good. You're educating a nation where there's a literacy, where a generation hasn't been educated. So you send them off to do this good work, and they get killed by the people who are supposed to be the good guys. But this is what they've always said about Afghanistan. You can't tell the good guys from the bad guys. A lot of these American officers working here worked in Iraq, where you knew who Al-Qaeda was. It was a foreign element in Iraq. In Afghanistan, the Taliban and their supporters are part of Afghan society. But when you talk to the senior commanders here, they say, listen, these are isolated incidents. This is only the second time that this has happened within an Afghan military unit. Other times it's happened within the police. So you've got to keep it in perspective. There's more than 100,000 foreign troops here now, and hundreds of thousands of Afghans and police and army. So we shouldn't exaggerate them, but it certainly is a cautionary tale.
There we are. That was Lise Doucette reporting there from Kabul. I should say she's also reporting on BBC television. And if you'd like to read some analysis of what's going on, Ian Pannell, our correspondent, has a piece online on Afghanistan, bbcnews.com. Ian Pannell's piece there. And also online, you may see the most shared story today, Parasailing Donkey. Police in southern Russia are investigating allegations of animal cruelty after a donkey was made to parasail, sort of go up on a parachute behind a boat. The donkey was set up into the sky by entrepreneurs hoping to attract people to their private beach. The donkey screamed and the children cried, regional police spokeswoman Larissa Tuchkova told AFP news agency. No one had the brains to call the police. BBCnews.com. Coming up later in the programme, we'll be talking a little more about Afghanistan and how the US dilemmas there echo Russia's two decades ago.
I think the main similarities is that both sides, when the end game came, recognized that they had to get out. The Russians recognized rather painfully that they were going to have to do something, and the US is beginning that painful process now.
How to get out. Right, other headlines. The leaders of Britain and the United States have described their special relationship as essential to international security and prosperity. As we've just heard, an Afghan soldier has killed two Americans and a fellow recruit at a military base in northern Afghanistan. A report says China has just surpassed the United States as the world's biggest consumer of energy. And Cuba is offering to free more of its jailed dissidents and says they won't be forced to go into exile. We'll have more on that later in the programme. So still the new British Prime Minister David Cameron is in Washington meeting President Obama. And the agenda, well, there's the BP spill and there's Afghanistan. But there is also the decision to release the man convicted of the Lockerbie airline bombing, Abdul Basit al-Megrahi. Now, he was released on the grounds that he was ill, close to death. But that was 11 months ago and he's still alive. And some in the United States were always opposed to the release and their anger is increasing. Especially as a medic earlier this month says there's a chance, albeit a small one, that he could live for many years. And there's something else. Public enemy number one, BP, has just started drilling off Libya. The Prime Minister and the President spoke about the issue at a news conference at the White House.
Releasing the Lockerbie bomber, a mass murderer of 270 people, the largest act of terrorism ever committed in the United Kingdom, was completely wrong. He showed his victims no compassion. They were not allowed to die in their beds at home, surrounded by their families. So in my view, neither should that callous killer have been given that luxury. That wasn't a decision taken by BP, it was a decision taken by the Scottish Government.
Oh, well, there we are. That was just the Prime Minister there. Well, we have him clearly unhappy. BP has come into this because it has just started drilling off the Libyan coast, as I say. Now, US congressmen have been asking, is that why Megrahi was released, to help BP get that deal? And so too have relatives of the Lockerbie victims, especially in the United States. Bert Ammerman is an American. His brother Tom was killed in the Lockerbie bombing. And he is also former president and spokesperson for the victims of Pan Am Flight 103. He lives in New Jersey.
BP is the one that got their hands in the caught in the cookie jar. But the United Kingdom is actively involved in this release, and so is the United States. There is no question in my mind that if either President Obama or Secretary of State Clinton had worked back channels to your government, Megrahi would still be in prison today. Big business pushed this issue. Oil pushed this issue. It was a blood for oil deal. When BP say they didn't mention Megrahi, please don't insult our intelligence. The 800-pound gorilla in the room has been Megrahi. Gaddafi has tried for years to get the release of Megrahi. Big business has been pushing this issue for nearly 15 years. They wanted to get into Libya, and their attitude basically was, well, it's a shame that those people died. Let's go make some money.
Well, it all seems to make sense, except for one thing. The British government didn't actually take the decision to release Megrahi. Because the Lockerbie plane crashed in Scotland and Mr. Megrahi was held in prison in Scotland, the decision to release him was taken by the Scottish government, specifically Scottish Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill, and I've been speaking to him. So the question that needs to be asked really is not did BP lobby the British government, it did, but did BP lobby the Scottish government? I asked him.
No, the Scottish Government has had no contact or representations from BP. What the discussions and deal that may or may not have been done between the British Government and BP, I don't know and can't comment on, but I can give you an absolute assurance that BP did not contact myself or the Scottish Government, and it formed no part of my decision.
Right, but the senators may still be interested in your decision, which was to release Mr. Al-Megrahi on health grounds. Now, as I understand it, the Scottish guideline is that if death is imminent, or I think the word is soon in the Scottish law, then you have the power to release. But it's 11 months now, and he's still alive.
Well, there's several criteria for compassionate release, but compassionate release is a part of Scots law that is carried out by the Cabinet Secretary for Justice, by myself and indeed by my predecessors. Certainly, one of the criteria is that life expectancy is 3 months or less. And the information put before me last August was that if Mr. Al-Megrahi remained in a Scottish prison cell, then the likelihood was that he would die within 3 months. On that basis, having served his sentence, having been lawfully convicted in Scotland, I exercised the advice and took the decision to release him on compassionate grounds, justice having been served, but mercy having to also be shown. I accept that it's now 11 months and he has not died. I think is what is clear is that the prognosis was based upon him being in a Scottish prison cell, and clearly he's returned to Libya. Equally, what is undeniable is that he is terminally ill, he has prostate cancer, treatment has ceased, and it is just a matter of time before he dies, and it was on that basis that I released him to go home and die.
So, sorry, are you suggesting that his prognosis is better in Libya than in Scotland?
No, I think what is clearly the case is that people react differently to cancer, but clearly your morale is a factor that gives you the will to live. I'm not medically qualified, and certainly the information put before me was that if he remained in a prison cell in Scotland, he would die within 3 months. What remains clear is that he is terminally ill and death is going to be very soon. As I say, I said at the time that he may live longer, he may die sooner. He has lived longer, but his life expectancy expectancy is limited because he is a terminally ill and sick man.
Yeah, I mean, it is a substantial difference between 3 and 11 months. So are you frustrated by the medical advice you received having been so poor?
Well, I accepted the evidence put before me. It was not simply the evidence provided by the Director of Health and Social Care at the Scottish Prison Service, but evidence from the prison governor and indeed from the parole board in Scotland. As a Cabinet Secretary for Justice, I required to accept that information, and indeed, as with every other application for compassionate release granted both by myself and indeed by any of my predecessors, where the criteria is met, then compassionate release is granted. In this instance, the criteria was met, and I did what my predecessors and myself before me had done, and that was to allow him to go home to die.
Given the extent of the controversy and the international aspect of the controversy, are you willing to publish the advice you received? I think at one stage you said you wanted to do that.
Well, we've published as much as we've been allowed to on the internet and on websites, and indeed they're available for all to see. There are some matters that we cannot publish because either consent has not been given, some by Mr. Al-Megrahi himself, some by the British government, some by the US government. So where we require consent and the consent is not given, we cannot publish. But every other matter that has been made available to us that we have felt it is relevant, we make available, because we do believe that we have to act openly, and throughout the course of these proceedings, that is what we have done.
What has Mr. Megrahi said he does not want you to publish?
Well, there's a variety of matters that Mr. Al-Megrahi has said that he does not wish published, and indeed, as I say, that's also reflected and represented by various governments either side of the Atlantic. Some of that relates to documentation and information with the Scottish Criminal Case Review Board. That's a matter over which I have no control. It's a matter that they've communicated with him. So there's a variety of matters published.
What about the medical records?
Well, some medical records are of no relevance because they relate to his previous matters, and I don't think that what happened to him as a boy is necessarily of any relevance.
Now then, one of the strange aspects of this is that many of the victims' relatives in the United States have a very firm conviction that Mr. Al-Megrahi was guilty, and some of those relatives of victims in Europe just don't believe that and think he was wrongly convicted. Do you have a view on that? I mean, have you ever considered that issue?
Well, I made it quite clear when I released Mr. Al-Megrahi that as the Cabinet Secretary for Justice, he had been lawfully convicted before a Scottish court. That is the position that I hold.
And there we are. That was the Scottish Justice Secretary, the man who actually took the decision to release Mr. Al-Megrahi, a decision very strongly criticised by both the British Prime Minister and the American President today, Kenny McCaskill. You are listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. The Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, has been in power for over 15 years now, and he wants more. His campaign for the next term began today at a rally in Kigali. So how did it go? Well, our correspondent, Rob Walker, was there.
It was a very well-organised event. Several thousand people crammed into the national stadium, the Amahoro Stadium. And I was here for the last elections, actually, in the 2003 presidential elections. And it was quite similar to that in some ways. The RPF, the ruling party, are an extremely well-organised party. They were bussing people in from early morning. Everyone was kitted out in the right T-shirts. Many people waving pictures of Paul Kagame, flying the flags of the RPF, the red, white and blue colours of the RPF. So it was a very big, well-organised rally that kicked off the campaign for President Kagame, and as you might expect, lots of enthusiasm among the people there in the stadium.
Are we voting exactly for Kagame?
Why is that?
Because he's a good leader. For the last 7 years, the roads, the hospital, I'm saying about health, economic, security, you have a full security. It's full because of him.
You're supporting President Kagame?
Absolutely. According to what he did for the last time, so much, you know, achievements. So according to the opinion, the public opinion, I think he's the best one. He's going to win.
Well, it's interesting hearing the enthusiasm there, Robin. You were there, as you say, in 2003. And what's surprising is that Paul Kagame actually only ever stood once before, didn't he, despite his long years in office, and at that election in 2003.
Yeah, that was the first time he stood for office in 2003. Of course, in effect, he's run Rwanda. His party, the RPF, have run Rwanda since the genocide in 1994. They've been the real power here. That was the first time he stood for election. He had 7 years in office, and now he's standing again. I mean, I should say that the people who are facing him in this election, I mean, obviously the RPF are putting lots of resources into the campaign, but the people facing him in this election are not people who are going to pose a real challenge to him. They're people who have not really been critical of him in the past. And I have to say, they're not viewed here as particularly credible opponents. So I think there's not really any doubt about the outcome of the election. It's just a question of how much President Kagame will win by. I think most people would say that here.
And we're going to discuss his record in just a moment. But just on the facts of the case when it comes to this election process, there are three parties running against him, but they're sort of fairly tame ones. And those who really oppose him have been blocked, right?
That's right. Well, the people who are really critical of him, the real opponents, you might say, haven't been able to stand in the election. They say they've been prevented from standing, and also they say they've been threatened and harassed as they've tried to register themselves as parties. I mean, the government's line, of course, is that that's not the case, that they haven't gone through the proper procedures, or in some cases there are outstanding criminal cases, court cases against them. But I have to say, really, it does seem it's been very difficult for those people who are critical of President Kagame to be able to stand against him in this election. And the people who are standing are not ones I think are going to pose a very significant challenge to him.
And that was Rob Walker at that rally there. Well, there is a lot of concern about the allegations of violence linked to this election and intimidation of opposition groups. But there are many in the West and in the country, as we've heard, who admire Paul Kagame for overseeing a period of growth and of reconciliation in Rwanda. Well, Karina Tasakian is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, and you've been denied a visa, I think, to go back to Rwanda because you're perceived as being sort of overly critical of the government. So when you hear voters there saying, look, the roads are better, the hospitals are better, we've got economic security, I mean, do you acknowledge that there is support for him now?
Well, certainly there is support, and also there have been significant achievements in Rwanda since the end of the genocide in terms of getting the country back on its feet again, in terms of development, in terms of the economy. So these are all real successes. But in terms of the political situation and in terms of the progress towards democracy, it's a different story. As your correspondent reported, in reality, the ruling party, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and President Paul Kagame are standing more or less unopposed. There are three other parties standing, but they're not real opposition parties. And as for the real opposition parties, two out of those three parties have not even been able to register. One of the leaders of these parties, Bernard Ntaganda of the PS in Barakuri, is currently in prison. He was arrested about 3 weeks ago. And last week, the vice president of one of the other opposition parties, the Green Party, was found murdered in very gruesome circumstances. All this in a climate where there have been increasing restrictions on freedom of expression in the last few months, with journalists being threatened. There was a journalist who was murdered, shot dead outside his home about 3 weeks ago. So this is the context in which the current presidential elections are about to take place.
Why is democracy so important?
Well, the Rwandan government itself has signed up to various international commitments, democratic principles. For example, in November of last year, Rwanda joined the Commonwealth. And as you know, some of the central principles of the Commonwealth are respect for freedom of expression, respect for democracy. And I think that if this government and if President Paul Kagame wants to build even greater support amongst the Rwandan population, then he can do so by showing that he's respecting their rights and opening up the political space.
I guess what I'm getting at is, I mean, I'm sure you're right that all those things have been signed and there may be hypocrisy in this, but for many Rwandans, wouldn't economic security be more important than democracy?
I think it's a question to put to the Rwandan people.
Well, we just did, and they said that they're very happy with what they've got.
Well, these are people who were interviewed at the rally, at the opening of the campaign of the ruling party. The reality in Rwanda is that anybody who has opinions that may be slightly different from those of the government are living in fear and are afraid of expressing those opinions. People who do express different opinions or criticisms are fearful of being arrested are now even fearful of being killed in light of the events of the last few weeks. There is also a law in Rwanda outlawing what they call genocide ideology, and this law in practice has also been used to silence political opposition and dissent.
Karina Tetsakian, thanks so much for joining us. And let's get another view now from Philip Gurevich, who's an author and journalist who wrote an acclaimed book on the genocide in Rwanda entitled We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. He joins us from New York. Now, you have, in the past anyway, been quite supportive of Paul Kagame's record. What do you think when you hear that there clearly are direct attacks now on democratic expression in the country?
Well, I would not say that I've been supportive of his record so much as identified the places where there's been progress, and I've also identified a lot of places in reporting on it where there have been big problems. And I don't think that anybody who's been watching it closely would say that the RPF government since the genocide has been a democratic government. That really hasn't been an accurate perception. So that to say that there's now less democracy than there was, let's say, during the last election or so, isn't the case. What you see is a continuation, and it's discouraging when one wants to see an increase in an opening towards democracy. The question really is, which way is everything moving? And I don't know that one can say that all of the events that Karina Tersakian just described, as if they were coming from the government, are coming from the government, or are all related. What you have is a climate where, as Kagame stands for re-election, some people came to challenge him who weren't allowed to stand. Some of them represented, in the government's view, and there was a fairly strong case against them, either genocidal ideology, and some were just obstructed. There's no question that there has not been, as your reporter pointed out, easy access to the political system for people who aren't already in it. But it's not clear that all of these events are who's behind them.
We don't know. And I mean, the government denies it, and the opposition.
It's very important, though, that when people suggest that there's this climate of fear, and the implication, for instance, from Human Rights Watch and others, is that this is somehow or other the government's responsibility. Clearly, it's the government's responsibility to try to guarantee security, but it doesn't mean that they are responsible for every one of these.
But come on, people have fled the country for fear of their lives, thinking the government want to kill them. I've spoken to people like that. They have
all through this period, right? And sometimes it's convincing, and sometimes it's less convincing. And so one of the questions is, it's not an open society. It's a society that comes with a very heavy hand. And one of the real issues is how that's all working out and whether, in fact, this government is providing anything towards building towards what I think is the real question, whether there will be a transition at the end of Kagame's second term of government. And obviously, these signs make people who care about that very worried, because they think, well, it looks like a consolidation of power, not just in a party, but in one man. And he continues to say, well, listen, I'm going to be reelected because I've done a good job and because there's nobody credible around here opposing me. And then I plan to retire. And we don't know if that's true. And I think that the judgment on his rule will really come down to that to a large degree. If he does leave and becomes the first retired ex-president who's a civilian in Rwanda in the country's history, he will be seen as a statesman, and many of his accomplishments will outweigh many of the things that are held against him. And I think that if he can't pull that off, it'll be seen as whatever he did that was good, and many of the things that you've heard him acclaimed for will come to be seen as greatly diminished and overshadowed by this tarnishing failure.
Thank you so much, Philip Gurevich there, who's the author of that book on the Rwandan genocide. Now, there has been controversy, as you've heard if you listen to the programme, in Europe for months now over plans to ban the face veil or niqab or burqa in various descriptions of various different types of covering. But the debate goes further afield than Europe. In fact, in Syria, there's been a ban now on face veils being worn in universities there, and some female students are not happy about it. From Damascus University, Lina Sinjab reports.
Builders are refurbishing the classrooms here, but that's not the only change taking place. In the lush green gardens of the university, some women students are dressed in jeans and t-shirts, their hair flowing freely. Many wear headscarves, while a few wear long flowing gowns, gloves and the niqab, with only their eyes visible. These two face the decision to remove their veils or not go to classes.
I don't accept with this decision. Because the university for all people, not for uncovering women or covering women.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for that. In my opinion, wrong. Why? It's my choice.
Many of the students agree. It's understood the government's decision came after families complained about the spread of the niqab at universities. The ban will apply only to women wearing full-face veils, not those who wear headscarves. Over inside the main hall, some sided with the government. 19-year-old biology student Razan wears a colourful headscarf and thinks the ban should be extended. She doesn't think the niqab should be allowed anywhere.
I don't think the niqab is a good thing. It's uncivilized. Even outside university, they shouldn't wear it.
An increasing number of women are wearing it in Syria, and that trend has been noticed by the secular government. Hundreds of school teachers who wore the niqab have been moved from the classroom into the back offices and administrative posts. Maryam is a school teacher who wears a long black veil covering her face, but agrees with the government's decision.
Although I wear the niqab myself, I think this decision is good for security. When I go into the university, I remove my niqab, but in the street, I put it on. I'm not against this decision.
Syria is not alone in taking action against the niqab. Many European countries are moving towards similar bans on the grounds veils are degrading to women. But here in the Middle East, the move is unusual and a sign the government here is asserting its control. Outside the gates of the university, students stroll along listening to music on their mobile phones and couldn't agree on whether the ban is right or wrong.
We need to go to university to improve our society. I don't know why refused to girls to go to university with niqab. It's a big problem to some people.
The ministry know about information about people here in Syria, okay, and what they need. So it's good.
It's just one of those issues people cannot agree about. That was Lina Sinjab there. Now, the politics of Cuba tends to move at a pretty glacial pace, which is one reason why there is quite a lot of interest in the recent pronouncement about dissidents there. Earlier this month, 52 were told they could be released, and 11 with families have already gone to Spain. More, I think, 9 due to fly out this week. But now is Cuba saying something else, that others above the 52 can also be released and can stay in Cuba. Michael Voss is in Havana. It seems that things are moving in one direction.
Yes, it does, Owen. There's the odd spanner in the works, though, at the same time. Now, what's happened now is that the president of Cuba's National Assembly, the parliament, Ricardo Alarcón, has said that the government here would like to release all the people in prison, referring, I believe, to the 167 political prisoners that the unofficial Cuban Human Rights Commission adds up. There's about 100 more beyond the 52 who will still be in jail. He's saying those who didn't commit murders, because some are in there for a bombing campaign in the 90s, the government does want to set free. And he also indicated that if they don't want to leave the country, they will be allowed to stay.
So that's a further concession on previous statements.
It's not an official statement. He was speaking to reporters on the sideline of a conference in Geneva. This is not something that's come out of any official statement from Havana. But it does look as if the Cubans are moving in that direction. The spanner in the works I was talking about earlier has come actually from the United States. The U.S. interest section in Havana has been phoning relatives of those who are being released, asking them to come in for a chat if they're interested in going to the United States, and what they're saying, rather than Spain. And what they're saying is that if anyone's freed under this church-agreed deal to go into exile in Spain, it will make it much more difficult for them then to move to the United States.
Right. Why are they doing that?
It's difficult to gauge at this point. I mean, I think there's been a lot of inquiries from those jailed prisoners and their families, particularly those who have relatives in the United States.
I see. They prefer to go to the States.
they would rather go to the States because they have families there. And what the US is saying is that once you can apply for asylum while you are in your country of origin for reasons of persecution, but once you step into a third country like Spain, then you will be treated as a regular, you know, would-be immigrant. You'll have to go through normal channels, which could take years.
Thank you very much. Michael Voss there. Now, a reminder of today's main news. The US President Barack Obama and the British Prime Minister David Cameron have held lengthy talks in Washington, saying the special relationship between the two countries is essential to their security and prosperity. As the two leaders met, there were more questions about BP's role in the decision to release the Libyan convicted of the Lockerbie bombing. And speaking on this programme, Scottish Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill told us why he took the decision to release him.
He is terminally ill. He has prostate cancer. Treatment has ceased, and it is just a matter of time before he dies. And it was on that basis that I released him to go home and die.
A couple of other headlines. Two Americans and two Afghans have died in a shooting incident at a military base in northern Afghanistan. And Cuba, as we've been hearing, is offering to free more of its exiled dissidents, jail dissidents, and says they won't be forced into exile. This is NewsHour, and back now to our main story in the programme. June brought grim news for the United States and Afghanistan. 60 personnel were killed, service personnel, and more than 500 injured. One recent poll showed that most Americans want the Obama administration to set a timeline now for complete withdrawal, and only a few believe the campaign's going well. To find out how the rising tide of casualties is affecting the national mood, Kevin Connolly went to Quantico. It's in Virginia, and it's a town with a strong military tradition.
Quantico, Virginia, with its rattling commuter trains and its neat little storefronts, could be any town, USA, except for one thing. Quantico is home to the United States Marines. There's a checkpoint on the main road, and every other shop is a barber's. Cutting hair is big business here.
When we walk down Main Street and we have Marines coming out of the barber shop, we always, always say, good job. You're doing an excellent job. We're proud.
Hello, town of Quantico.
Iris Tharp is mayor of Quantico, daughter of a former Marine Corps Sergeant Major, who believes America's patriotic attachment to its armed forces is strong enough to absorb this summer's uptick in casualties, for now, at least.
I have never questioned the mission. I'm patriotic, and that's how loyal military families are.
On Main Street Quantico, you find the Command Post pub, where the music is loud, the beer is cold, and the decor is pure Marine. An old recruiting poster tells you that the Corps needs a few good men. But for the American public, the big questions are about what happens to those good men once they join. Is Afghanistan winnable? How can the administration hint it might be ready to bring some troops home next year when it's still pouring extra forces in now? And is the mission to build Afghanistan or just beat it? The boss, Al Gasser, is a Vietnam vet who says the biggest problem with the campaign is not the casualty figures, but the looming sense of unwinnability.
I don't see that we should have had a beginning, and I don't see that there will be an end other than we'll leave just like the Russians did. I don't understand how the Department of State can continually make these decisions to go into countries whose history is greater than ours by thousands of years with local animosities, tribal animosities. They have no idea how to combat that. They're talking, you know, strategic hamlets in Vietnam didn't work. It's not going to work in Afghanistan trying to protect certain areas. We're not going to win that war by killing people. And I don't think we're going to win the war in any manner. I just don't see there is an end to it. There's no plan to win the war.
All Americans are awed by the service of our own men and women in uniform, who've borne a burden as great as any other generation's. They and their families embody the example of selfless sacrifice.
In the jargon of American politics, Barack Obama has ownership of Afghanistan. A war to win, he called it, where Iraq was just a war to end. But there are doubters in his own party, like Congressman Jerry Connolly, whose district borders Quantico. Faced with rising casualties, he wants America to stop talking about why it got into Afghanistan and start talking about when to get out.
I think the American public has already shown enormous patience. This is the longest war, arguably, in our history. We've already been in Afghanistan for 8 years. Now, that's longer than the American Revolutionary War, the Civil War, Vietnam War. I think the American public has shown remarkable patience. But I think, understandably, they want a lot more clarity about why are we there? What are the objectives? What is the exit strategy? This can't be an endless, open-ended commitment.
Not every town, of course, is as patriotic as Quantico. For many Americans, the closest this war gets is the moment when a pilot on an internal flight asks passengers for a standing ovation for any soldiers who happen to be aboard. For now, rising casualties are not changing that. Eventually, though, you sense that the lack of a convincing exit strategy just might.
Kevin Connolly. Well, today's conference in Kabul on the future of Afghanistan has been held against that background, and commentators, even sympathetic to Western military forces, are beginning to talk now in terms of withdrawal. But what would happen after that? More bluntly, is this really a repeat of the Soviet defeat in Afghanistan? Well, Selig Harrison is the head of the Asia programme at the Centre for International Policy, and he actually co-authored a book on this issue of the Soviet withdrawal and how it was managed. And before discussing the similarities, I asked, what are the differences?
There are two basic differences. The first is that the Russians had started with United Nations diplomacy as early as 1982. They were cooperating with the UN Undersecretary General Cordovez, who was trying to negotiate a way out for them. And I think that's a very basic difference. One other very important difference is that the Russians had an army in Kabul under Mr. Najibullah, which was a Pashtun army, whereas the United States got involved with the Tajiks, the ethnic minority in Afghanistan, when they first came in. And therefore, the army that we're trying to help Karzai build has 70% of its battalion commanders are Tajiks. They can't recruit in the Pashtun areas where the Taliban is. They can't fight there.
Well, that is a very big difference and an important one. What are the main similarities, would you say?
Well, I think the main similarities is that both sides, when the end game came, recognized that they had to get out. The Russians recognized rather painfully that they were going to have to do something, and the U.S. is beginning that painful process now.
I think many historians would agree that the Soviet defeat in Afghanistan had very profound consequences for the Soviet Union and was one of the key factors in leading to its dissolution. Will the American defeat in Afghanistan have similar long-term consequences?
Well, it depends on whether it's really a defeat or whether the U.S. Is able to make a graceful transition in a political sense to a new situation in Afghanistan through cooperating with the deals that Karzai is trying to make with Pakistan to stabilize the Pashtun areas by giving the Taliban local power in some of the provinces of southern Afghanistan. You could have an American disengagement that I don't think would have necessarily adverse effects to the United States. I think it's going to be much worse for the U.S. if the U.S. attempts to stay in a situation which it's getting increasingly untenable, in which there are more and more civilian casualties, and in which the hatred of the United States in Afghanistan grows. And I think long-range U.S. interests are going to be damaged more by an endless quagmire than by a graceful disengagement.
Well, it's interesting you say you think there is a graceful way out, because I think virtually everything I've read suggests that after the Western forces leave, civil war is bound to follow.
That depends on the circumstances under which the U.S. leaves, of course. If the U.S. Hangs in a sort of last-ditch effort, keeps trying to pursue these untenable counterinsurgency tactics, which make no sense because the more foreign forces you have, the more resistance you have, and it's an endless quagmire. But if the U.S. were to go for a diplomatic way out, particularly one that would be brokered by the United Nations and involve the regional neighbors who share the U.S. desire to prevent a Taliban takeover, I think with a regional diplomacy, the U.S. could leave gracefully. But at the present time, the U.S. government is not thinking in those terms.
If a Soviet general from those old days were to be in Washington now and sort of sitting in the White House, and after dinner President Obama said, look, tell me what you learned, what do you think that conversation would be like?
I think the Russian general would say to the U.S., you're going to have to talk to the Taliban. The question is, what are you going to have to give them? And I think if the Russian general were to talk to the Americans now, he would say, let's get together. Let's get together with India. Let's get together with Iran. Let's get together with China, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. Let's get a way out that creates a UN oversight of the whole process so that things do not fall apart.
Selig Harrison on those lessons from 20 years ago, and that's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thanks for listening from Owen Bennett-Jones. Goodbye.